Ukraine will not succeed in liberating its lands without the provision of long-range missiles, argues Colby Badois. For Kyiv, the ability to strike operational and strategic targets deep inside enemy territory, i.e. inside Russia itself, is not a whim, but it's a crucial necessity. But are allies framing their strategy and aligning their production and logistic capabilities accordingly? The manufacturer of German Taurus missiles has halted production due to lack of orders. Meanwhile, Olaf Scholz remains adamant in refusing to supply Ukraine with long-range weapons. Do the Western allies want victory, or do they merely want to prevent Ukraine from being annihilated by a revanchist Russian empire? Please like and subscribe to see more of the fantastic speakers that we feature on Silicon Curtain, and definitely add comments as it helps our content to be discoverable by more people. Please also do check out the validated Ukrainian charities that appear in the description of the video. Colby Badois is a security columnist at The Insider, a Russia-focused independent media outlet. He is a defense and news analyst with an emphasis on procurement, arms sales, and military aid to Ukraine. Colby is based in Toronto, Ontario, in Canada. Welcome to the channel.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
And we're going to put links to various things that I mentioned there. But I think if people really want to understand the detail about military procurement, the aid package, and in some ways why it might be falling short of Ukraine's requirements, I definitely recommend they look at your Twitter feed, which has an extraordinary amount of in-depth detail there. Well, let's start by breaking down the 61 billion aid package, because if you superficially scan media outlets, you'd think, hey, all this money's going to Ukraine, fantastic. But there is a big gap, isn't there, between the reality and what Ukraine is actually going to receive from this package.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote a thread about what the actual contents of this latest quote-unquote Ukraine aid bill was last week, and it's been really, I guess it actually hasn't been surprising, but it's been very unfortunate, disappointing to see how many media organizations, how many journalists, ones that are ostensibly should be reputable as well, are just totally misrepresenting what the content of this bill is. You might see a lot of numbers out there, 60 or $61 billion. And there were so many journalists who were saying that it was $60 billion worth of military aid going directly to Ukraine, which sounds like a huge number, $60 billion worth of military aid or security assistance. But it's not actually true. If you actually read the bill, it's only a fraction of that is actual military aid available for Ukraine. If you add up all the actual money in the bill and then combine that with the authorities to provide assistance from US stockpiles, you get to $23.6 billion would be the total value of security assistance available for Ukraine included in the bill, which is a much, much smaller number. And if you only take the actual money in the bill available for that purpose, it's $15.8 billion. So basically just a quarter of the bill is actual dollars going to military aid for Ukraine. So huge disparity there. And it just really shows how the pervasive narratives emerging based on the reporting in the media are just really divorced from what the bill actually says if you take the time to read it. So this basically explains a lot of my work, is that I see so much bad information out there. So I try and explain to people, what is actually in these bills that are ostensibly about providing aid to Ukraine, and try and put out just better information.
Are politicians to some extent also culpable here? Because this detail, is it through sort of sloppiness, poor communication, or to some extent, do they really actually not want to publicize the full detail to the voting public? Does it serve politicians' interests that I would say sort of inaccurate or sloppy or superficial reporting is what actually is the coverage that people see?
Yeah, good question. I think that Certainly, a large part of this is the way in which the government, the US government in this case, does communicate the information as well, and the way that they're structuring the legislation to begin with. I point that out in the thread that I wrote about this, how it's being advertised by the Biden administration. They're saying this is our Ukraine aid bill. That's their own language that they use, that this is aid for Ukraine. But within the bill, there's all of this money that doesn't actually go to Ukraine and really is only tangentially related to Ukraine at all. There's billions of dollars to fund the operations of US European Command because there's all these extra United States military units that have been deployed to Europe in the wake of the invasion. And some of those units are involved in helping coordinate military aid deliveries to Ukraine, but most of them are not. Most of them are actually just like combat units that have been deployed to kind of reassure the Eastern Front members of the NATO alliance. So all of those billions of dollars, it's not really doing anything for Ukraine. It's just paying salaries of US personnel and paying the expenses of moving troops and equipment around. So all of that money is included in these Ukraine aid bills, but it's not money for Ukraine. But the average person just sees, oh, well, there's this $60 billion Ukraine aid bill. All this money is going direct to Ukraine, when in fact it's not. So that's very much a strategic communications failure by the administration in the way that they're requesting the money from Congress. And it's a failure by Congress as well to say to the administration, well, listen, I mean, we should pass a bill that does aid to Ukraine, and then we can pass a separate bill that addresses some of these other requirements for the US military. And it would be prudent to split those two rather than bundling them all together. And then people get the impression that all of the money is for Ukraine. And then, of course, as I was saying, the media, whose job it really is to actually explain things to the public, none of them take the time to actually read the bills. They're just basically regurgitating whatever they hear said by either the Biden administration or by Congress in writing the legislation. They just take their talking points and then repeat them without actually doing any of their own investigation into what the actual bill says.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? And so I guess my ignorance of the system here is who actually drafts this level of detail? Do politicians, are there people in the administration who do understand the ins and outs of this, or are they also beholden to, say, their own, I was going to call them apparatchiks, but you know what I mean? They're beholden to their own civil service to give them a story. Or is it likely that people like Jake Sullivan and others are really diving into the detail, parsing it, working out all these budget pots and implications like you are? Or is that quite unlikely? Is this all essentially structured by, mandarins and bureaucrats?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And we don't really have great clarity on this in a previous thread that I wrote, which was extremely long, over 100 tweets. But this is all very complicated stuff. I asked this question is, what's really the genesis of the legislation and the budget requests? So in the American system, the president, who heads the executive branch, they submit budget requests to Congress, and Congress, it's their job to actually pass the legislation, pass the appropriations, all the money that the government spends that has to be voted on by Congress. So the administration's role is to send requests saying, we want this amount of money for this program, whether it's for roads or bridges, healthcare, social security, defense. Or in this case, they're sending supplemental appropriations requests to fund foreign assistance and other purposes for Ukraine or other countries. So they write out a list of the amount of money they want for different specific programs within different appropriations accounts for different US departments of the federal government. And then it's up to Congress to evaluate that request and decide whether they're going to say yes, no, give them more money, give them less money, cut some things out, add some things in. That's how the process works. And it's not exactly clear on the part of the administration, how are they coming to determine what their actual requirements are. How do they decide we want this amount of money for this and we want this amount of money for that? That's unclear. We don't really have a peek inside the window at how the sausage is getting made, so to speak. And that's something that would be very interesting and beneficial to learn is this really being tightly coordinated by Jake Sullivan and the U.S. National Security Council, or is it the Department of Defense is sending them a list of what they want and they're basically saying yes to whatever the DoD says, or they're saying no, you can't have this much. Is the Office of Management and Budget, who are ultimately responsible for crafting these requests and submitting all the budgetary asks to Congress, are they weighing in and saying no, we're not going to ask for this much money here, we're going to ask for this much? That's an open question, and it's unclear what the issue is, because there's definitely a, as I said, the way that they're asking for the funds, packaging all these things together, which really shouldn't be packaged together because it creates confusion for the public. It's unclear how that's happening, and it's also unclear why is it that the administration is asking for a lot less funding to support Ukraine than they should have, given what the reality of the situation is on the ground. Ukraine obviously is having a lot of challenges with the amount of ammunition that they have. That's been fairly well documented. So the administration should be going to Congress and making a more realistic request to them to adequately resource Ukraine's defenses, because since the beginning of the war, they've really just been asking for the bare minimum, rather than really having an honest and transparent conversation with Congress about what is it going to take to actually support Ukraine so they can defend themselves from Russia.
And we haven't even mentioned the word strategy yet. And I think, wouldn't it be fundamental to the ask on the kind of equipment, systems, munition, etc., that you need, would be to align it to a strategy and then explain that budget requirement in terms of that strategy? Is this the fundamental problem, though, that we do not have a clearly articulated strategy? We do not have a clearly articulated idea of what a victory means. Now, the Ukrainians know what victory means, but this, it seems to me, has not been clearly articulated either in Washington or Berlin in these sort of 2 and a bit years of full-scale warfare.
Yes, absolutely. I would say that this is really the fundamental problem that exists, certainly in the United States, also in Germany, as you point out, with the Scholz government, but overall, in the NATO alliance and Ukraine Defense Contact Group, all of the countries supporting Ukraine, there is no unanimous agreement around this question about what is the strategic objective. And this has been a huge complaint of the US Congress since the beginning of the war, particularly from a lot of Republicans, some who are asking not in good faith, but many of them who are asking in good faith, like, what is the actual strategy here? We want to know how is Ukraine going to be supported so they can defend themselves and actually repel the Russian invasion? And when the Biden administration gets asked this question, their answer is always some variation of, oh, well, we're here to support Ukraine as long as it takes. We want Ukraine to be a sovereign, independent country that's able to resist Russian aggression. And that's not a strategy. That's not even really a clearly defined policy goal. Those are still very vague terms about what the administration is asking for. It's quite open-ended, particularly the as long as it takes. That's one of the most frequent sort of talking points we hear from them, that they will support Ukraine as long as it takes. And that's quite alarming to a lot of Americans, rightfully so. And it's especially strange because President Biden withdrew American forces from Afghanistan after 20 years, saying that, oh, well, we were there too long. But now he's making this sort of open-ended commitment that the United States will continue to provide support to Ukraine basically indefinitely, which raises concerns that there is no actual goal, and there's certainly no strategy. If you don't have a goal, you can't even craft a strategy. That having a clearly defined policy objective is step number one, and we haven't even gotten that far. So logically, there can't be a strategy for the administration to outline what steps are going to be taken if there's not even a very clearly defined goal in mind.
So what you've mentioned there implies at the very least survival of Ukraine and retaining those parts of its territory that it currently controls. I guess that is almost like a minimal implication in this non-expressed strategy. And with the ammunition famine, as it's been labeled, over the last sort of 6 months, as it started to get depleted, and of course this aid has been held up in the US political system, is it fair though to say this aid has arrived just in the nick of time and that there is enough in there at least to help Ukraine hold the line? Or in your view, is there enough in there?
Yeah, another good question. It depends on how quickly things can arrive, and certainly there's definitely some defense articles, some ammunition, some equipment is certainly by now already in Ukraine and probably on the front line. But there is a lot of ground to make up because the United States hadn't been providing these regular drawdowns from its inventory to provide ammunition and other equipment to Ukraine. Over the past months, they suspended without just cause those deliveries in December, and then they made what they characterized as a one-off emergency drawdown in March, and then just now, as the new bill passed, they're resuming, and they announced last Wednesday a $1 billion drawdown out of U.S. inventory. But there's an awful lot of ground to be made up here due to the periods where Ukraine wasn't getting any direct drawdowns from U.S. inventory. And even last year, during December, November, October, when the United States was providing these regular drawdowns, most of those packages were quite small, even compared to the fairly modest packages that Ukraine had been receiving for much of the war, talking about, $200 million or less worth of equipment being provided to them in each package. So Ukraine was already being quite starved badly then, and so adding all that up, there's a lot of ground to catch up here. A lot of units need a very significant amount of assistance in order to get their stocks back up to a point where they're going to have sufficient ammunition to repel Russian attacks. And certainly there's been lots of reporting on the Russians looking to press their advantage that they have right now before more aid starts to flow in. So I think Ukraine certainly should be able to stabilize the front, but things could get a little bit worse before they get better because it's taken so long.
And I've heard, some soldiers, including, very accomplished ones who've been fighting, some of them since 2014, they've been describing the core part of this war actually as an artillery duel, utilizing vast stocks of ammunition, requiring obviously huge capabilities in terms of, howitzers, artillery pieces, and so on. Is this still an important component of the war? And is the 155 millimeter artillery shells that Ukraine so badly needs, is this still a core requirement for that sort of, let's say, defensive Ukrainian strategy?
Oh, absolutely. The war has not changed in that regard since it actually really began in 2014 when Russia initially invaded the Donbass. Since then, artillery has figured very heavily into the nature of the fighting between Russia and Ukraine. And although there are new aspects of the war now with the full-scale invasion that didn't exist back then, but artillery has certainly been a constant, and the volume of artillery needed has obviously increased as the scope of the war increased with the full-scale invasion. So artillery is just as important in the war now as it was at the beginning in 2022 and all the way back to 2014. So Ukraine still needs ammunition, not just 155, but they still need ammunition for legacy Soviet guns as well, because they still have those in inventory. 152, 122, 122 millimeter grad rockets as well. Ammunition of all sorts is critical, in addition to long range fires as well. These are all critical components. It is very much an artillery war still. Artillery is one of the main killers on both sides. A lot gets written about drones, and certainly that's another important aspect to the war. But a lot of the work that drones are doing is spotting for artillery as well. So neither side is using FPVs to replace conventional tube or rocket artillery.
So mentioning drones, I think, is an important component here because in a recent interview, it was very compellingly discussed the importance of drones and whether they reinforce or support more defensive or offensive warfare. And certainly the person I was speaking to then made the case that actually they have turned a 21st century war into essentially an early 20th century war, turned it back to the kind of stalemate we see in the First World War, because essentially drones favor not mobile warfare or even combined arms, but it favors a kind of defensive, static kind of warfare that we are seeing in Ukraine. Do you support that idea? And if so, what is the actual impact of using drones at scale from what we've seen in Ukraine so far?
Yeah, I think the proliferation of drones certainly makes adds challenges to maneuver, because there's almost always something watching. So and just the fact that Ukraine doesn't have just doesn't have the resources to execute maneuver warfare is a big problem as well. Like to execute combined arms maneuver warfare, you have to have an army that's built, equipped, trained to do that. And that's definitely not the position that the Ukrainians find themselves in, not really the position the Russians find themselves in either. So both armies' inability to do that has certainly created more of a static nature of fighting now. Certainly the availability of all these drones, if you're trying to go on the offense or executing maneuvers, it's very easy to be have your forces identified. And then if you have artillery available, then there's plenty of instances where you can see either side on the offensive and then getting spotted by these drones or unmanned aerial systems, and then being attacked with indirect fire or loitering munitions. So it does make any maneuver operations risky. But even in a static setting, we can see that drones are quite deadly there as well. If you don't have very well constructed defensive positions, then drones can be quite lethal in that case as well. But certainly these comparisons to World War I mean, just if nothing else, the landscape. There are so many videos that you see off the front line, and the landscapes look remarkably similar to those from World War I, with just the fields completely ruined by all the vehicles and all the artillery fire, shell craters everywhere, all the destroyed trees. It is quite hellish looking at these videos. Captured by soldiers on the ground or by the drones in the air of what the landscape looks like. So there is some merit to the comparisons to the First World War there, I think.
So if we are to, in some ways, break out of this, let's say we were to fully align behind a Ukrainian victory, which would entail retaking Donbas and would entail also taking back Crimea eventually. I think that's sort of clear there. On top of that, you've got reparations, you've got returning the kidnapped children. There's all sorts of sort of implications and obligations that follow from that. But a basic description would be to reconstitute Ukraine's territorial integrity and protect its future economy by allowing it to control that Black Sea region without threat of Russian reincursions in future. What kind of munitions capability would we need to supply? And I guess crucially, what would we be doing with our own supply chains, production facilities, which we have not yet done, in order to produce munitions at the scale that would be required?
So Ukrainians need essentially just a lot more of everything they've received, and they have received a lot. They've received a wide variety of different capabilities, but just the scale has been very insufficient in terms of the quantities that we are delivering equipment in. And then there are some capabilities that just have been off the table or have been off the table for much of the war and are only now finally starting to come in. So the ATACMS, US Army Tactical Missile System, is a very good example of that. So there definitely needs to be we need to erase all of these red lines that we have drawn for ourselves. We're not going to provide this, we're not going to provide that. Those all have to go. ATACMS, the German Taurus cruise missile. There's some other air-launched cruise missiles from the United States, which would be very beneficial for Ukraine. So those are the kinds of things that Ukraine doesn't have right now that they definitely are going to need if they're going to have any chance of winning that this war.
And there's
Aside
been
from
delays and prevarications. I mean, how much of that stuff, and F-16s has been talked about now for 2 years solid, after the decision was finally made that actually they could have some, maybe older models rather than the latest ones with the latest electronic warfare in. But when is Ukraine going to get them, and what kind of quantities is it going to get them in?
Yeah, so all the reporting seems to indicate that we should see some F-16 start to arrive in Ukrainian service this summer. But of course, it's going to be limited quantities to begin with, as they still train additional pilots, train additional ground crews. They're not going to get all of them that have been pledged right at the start. So it will take some time for the Ukrainian F-16 force to be fully sort of constituted up to the point of the total number that have been committed by the various donor countries. So we shouldn't have too high hopes for the F-16s for that reason, that we're not going to see huge quantities to begin with. And as well, they are going to be l limited in capability relative to a lot of the aircraft the Russians have. They will be capable, and they will be an asset for the Ukrainian Air Force, but Russia still has a lot more aircraft, and they have a lot of aircraft that are technically superior because these are older model F-16s. Even though they have been updated, they're definitely not on the same level as a brand new F-16 would be. And one of the open questions is, what are we going to provide along with these F-16s? What kind of munitions? What kind of targeting pods? These are all important questions. As I was saying, air-launched cruise missiles, what is the United States willing to do there for Ukraine? Are they willing to provide things like SLAM-ER? Are they willing to provide things like JASSM? These are air-launched cruise missiles similar to the British Storm Shadow, French Scalp-EG. So these are all really important things for Ukraine to have in order for F-16s to be a relevant factor on the battlefield.
It does seem that the US administration did provide ATACMS even prior to the vote. I think that was a surprise to some people, although the US has previously provided capabilities around HIMARS without announcing it. And of course, the element of surprise meant that Ukraine could hit a number of Russian facilities highly successfully. But as a system, how important is the supply of these longer range ATACMS? How do you think Ukraine will use them, and what is the importance? And I guess a subsequent question to that is, do these systems as standalone really not have too much benefit? Is it only in the context of how they're used in conjunction with, say, HIMARS, Scalp, Storm Shadow, etc., in a more sort of, complex deployment? Is that their true value?
Yeah, absolutely. So ATACMS is very important, and I've been banging this drum for a long time. Now, no single weapon is decisive or war-winning. There's no silver bullets, but ATACMS is very important, and it will be ex extremely difficult for Ukraine to win the war without them. And yes, the administration did back in September of last year provide a small number, reportedly 20 of the oldest attack-ams, the M39 or the Block 1. And we saw right away that Ukraine was very successful with those missiles. They targeted Russian air bases, destroyed a large number of helicopters. And now recently it was reported back in March that additional TACMs were going to be provided in that package. And then just in the last couple of weeks, we heard that there was a TACM strike on Zhankoy in Crimea, which is a very important logistics hub there, intersection of rail lines. So that was attacked by TACMs, and now of course the administration has publicly disclosed that yes, they had provided the TACMs, and not only did they provide more of the oldest Block 1 TACMs, but they were going to provide the newer TACMs variants, which have longer range, 300 kilometers instead of 160 kilometers, and they're going to provide or had provided or in the process of providing over 100, and National Security Advisor Sullivan said that they were going to continue to be able to provide a large quantity of these missiles to Ukraine. So that's very important because Ukraine needs the ability to strike deeper behind Russian lines. Russia can strike anywhere in Ukrainian territory with impunity, but Ukraine has been very limited in the targets that it can strike because the munitions that we've given them just didn't have the same range. So having a 300 kilometer range missile means that pretty much all of Crimea can be held at risk. Any Russian airbase, any Russian logistics node, all of these strategic targets can be hit now with ATACMS. And of course, Ukraine already had the Storm Shadow and the CLPG, and those can certainly reach anywhere in Crimea as well, including the Kerch Bridge. But ATACMS provides different capabilities than Storm Shadow. And last year, I wrote a lengthy thread on ATACMS explaining all this, the differences in the capabilities, because ATACMS is a ballistic missile or a quasi-ballistic missile, whereas Storm Shadow is a subsonic cruise missile. They're very, very different capabilities, and particularly the fact that ATACMS has the first variants have the cluster munition payload. Those are very, very, very potent weapons for targeting air bases because the cluster munitions can spread out and destroy lots of aircraft that are on the tarmac, and the Russians make very limited use of hardened aircraft shelter, so their aircraft are typically quite vulnerable to being destroyed on the tarmac. And ATACMS is also very, very effective at destroying Russian air defense batteries. So every Russian destroyed air defense battery makes it more likely that these air-launched cruise missiles like Storm Shadow, CLPG can get through. It makes it safer for Ukrainian aircraft to operate. And having both of those missiles together, you can generate what's called a complex raid. So much like we just witnessed Iran execute against Israel, where they fired drones, the Shahed drones, which Russia of course uses on against Ukraine on a daily basis, and they fired cruise missiles, and they fired medium-range ballistic missiles as well, and they synchronized all of them to reach Israel roughly at the exact same time. That's called a complex raid. Ukraine now has the ability to do that to Russia as well, where they can fire cruise missiles at a certain target. And then they can fire ballistic missiles as well to arrive at the same target or similar targets in the general area, arriving at the same time. And that makes it very challenging for Russian air defense to intercept them because their radars have a very difficult time searching and tracking both ballistic targets and air-breathing targets, cruise missiles at the same time. So giving Ukraine the ability to generate those complex raids, which Russia, of course, is already generating against them, that's a very potent weapon for Ukraine, or very potent capability for Ukraine to now have to take the fight back to Russia and sort of even the scales.
And this is an interesting area, isn't it? Because I think many of us would have been relatively surprised at the apparent ease. I'm sure it's not that easy. I'm sure it takes a huge amount of skill and dedication. But the way Ukraine has been hitting Russian oil refineries and various logistics capabilities to do with oil, That may well even be expanding and increasing as it becomes apparent that Russia is still making substantial amounts of money, and that's probably going up in order to fund its war machine. It's been a surprise that Ukraine has been able to get these drones through. What do we know about it? Are they 100% successful, or is there a much lower strike rate? Is Russia able to take out some drones but not all of them? Do we know the mechanics of how these long-range drone attacks work?
I don't know that we have super high quality information on this because we're basically in large part relying on what the Russians say, but the Ukrainians certainly have their own assessments of how many of these are getting through. And I actually saw a statistic this morning that about only 20% actually were getting to the target, with the rest being shot down by Russian air defense. So it is a large number that are failing. But even if 20% get through, we can see that there is some significant damage that can be caused to these Russian refineries. That said, there is a bit of a misnomer here that these long-range drones can be a replacement for Ukraine having proper purpose-built cruise missiles or other missiles. Which the Russians are having in some quantity and are using against them. Ukraine is resorting to these drones out of desperation because the munitions that we have provided to Ukraine have come with the provision that they are not to be used on Russian sovereign territory. You can use them in Crimea, you can use them in Donbass, but don't strike Russia directly. And we can see there hasn't been any Storm Shadow or Scalpy G strikes on Russian territory, even though the missile has more than capable range to do so. It hasn't happened. So Ukraine has to resort to these less effective drones because, even though, yes, they are cheaper to build than a cruise missile, if 20% of them, only 20% of them are getting through, and the amount of damage that they can do to the target because they're carrying much smaller payloads. The warheads on these drones are much smaller than a Storm Shadow missile, for example. You have to actually do a cost-benefit analysis there. You know, how much are you investing in these drones? A bunch of them are going to get shot down, and then how much damage do they actually do? They're actually less cost-effective than a cruise missile would be, especially an American cruise missile, because the United States has the capacity to build, a JASSM-ER, for example, for like $1 million, which is a very, very affordable capability given what that missile can do. So Ukraine is unfortunately resorting to less effective and less cost effective means because of these restrictions that have been put on them. And this is really, aside from just the missiles themselves, this denial. This refusal of them to be allowed to use the missiles, the munitions we're giving them to hit Russia, this is so important. And Ukraine just will not win this war, full stop, if that policy continues. If Ukraine can't hit a high-value military target in Russia, but Russia can still, with impunity, strike anywhere in Ukraine, they're not going to win. There's just no way. They have to be able to hit logistics centers, military industry, command posts, troop concentrations, bridges. All of these targets in Russia are legitimate military targets. And if Ukraine is forbidden from hitting them, they're not going to win.
And on the other hand, you've got Patriots, which are incredibly important in the air defense of cities like Kiev, especially. And we saw the impact of when these really started to run low. Russia was able to take out a big chunk of the energy infrastructure in a city like Kharkiv. Now, again, the media, and some in the media, I don't want to tar everyone in the media with the same brush, but some in the media had some extremely poor quotes on this, which is Russia's taken the gloves off finally, or Russia's decided to hit Ukrainian energy infrastructure. I mean, my understanding is that they've been trying to hit these things all along, but it has been the lack of air defense, or it has been the air defense capability that's prevented that from happening. So that's a completely poor framing of that. However, do we also have a problem here in that Patriot is not necessarily that cheap a system, and yet we have combinations, you say, of ballistic missiles coming across. We have relatively cheap Iranian drones coming across. And we also got a bit of a problem here in that we're using assets to destroy Russian offensive capability, which is sometimes more expensive than what they're throwing at Ukraine. Sometimes it's not.
Yeah, well, a fundamental problem of air and missile defense is that it is absolutely more expensive to defend against these attacks. The cost of the systems, the cost of the interceptors are more expensive than the missiles that they're going to shoot down in most cases. And this is why air and missile defense is not actually really a solution. It's a temporary reprieve, but the fundamental problem is you have an enemy that has capacity to generate these raids against you, and the only way to stop that is to go on the offense yourself and destroy those capabilities before they can be used against you. So air and missile defense gives you breathing room. It allows you to survive long enough to go on the counteroffensive and try and destroy the enemy's own capabilities. It is not feasible to just play catch indefinitely with Russian missiles and drones. But that's basically what Ukraine is being expected to do right now. As I was just saying, we're not letting them prosecute these targets within Russia. So we're just sending them air defenses and hoping that eventually Russia is going to run out. Well, Russia is probably not going to run out. The Shahed drones can be built for not that much. Russia has been relatively successful in circumventing sanctions with the help of China and other countries, and have been able to increase their production of missiles. So the United States and other countries are going to be very taxed to produce more air defense interceptors than the Russians will be able to produce missiles and drones to strike Ukraine with. So although Patriot is an expensive system, it's not a cost prohibitive system, and Ukraine certainly needs more just to keep them alive. But again, that's a short-term reprieve. We need to be enabling them to take the fight back to Russia and try and destroy their capabilities, because otherwise Ukraine will ultimately again lose if we're just playing defense the whole time.
And talking of expensive capability, also you get these narratives, and this which taps into another area I know you follow closely and are expert in, and this is Russian propaganda narratives. And of course, it's always painted by sort of vatniks and supporters of Russia, and even those who say unconsciously fall into the trap of that propaganda, that somehow Russia is inevitable, its resources are inexhaustible, its supply of soldiers is endless. You know the kind of drill there. It's like, don't even try to resist because defeat against such a mighty enemy is inevitable. However, if we look at particular weapon systems such as T-90 and BPM-3, is Russia's capability to renew those resources, create new units, is that far more difficult than, say, sort of, popping out new Shahed using third-party components supplied by Iran, China, and indeed the West?
Yeah, I would say that this is an area where we certainly have the advantage in the West, is that a very significant portion of Russia's defense production for ground systems is refurbishing their existing inventories. And they have very deep stocks from the Cold War. So they're taking all of these vehicles out of storage and then refurbishing them into usable condition. So that's a very large portion of their defense industry is doing that, as opposed to just building new vehicles completely from scratch. So they will, based on their current loss rate, and their losses are still considerable, even though things are not great for the Ukrainians, the Russians still are taking quite significant losses in men and vehicles. This is a problem that they're going to run into when the stocks get further exhausted. They're going to have a limited ability to produce brand new vehicles from scratch. And the combined industrial capacity of the West will certainly exceed their ability, or should exceed their ability, to produce brand new vehicles if, again, we ramp up our own defense production further. That's an advantage that we will have. But the question is, can we keep Ukraine alive long enough in the interim? That's an open question, and it's not a good again, it's not a good strategy to just bank on defeating Russia through a war of attrition. That's never a good idea. If you're gonna try and defeat Russia through a war of attrition, you need to be inflicting vastly more casualties on them than they are on you. And that's certainly not the situation that Ukraine is in right now. Both sides are taking heavy casualties, and obviously Russia's got a bigger population, and the Ukrainians are having a lot of their own challenges around this political issue of mobilization and who will be mobilized, who will not be mobilized. That's another very significant issue. We can give Ukraine all of the equipment in the world, but they wouldn't have the soldiers to man that equipment unless they make some decisions about inducting additional manpower into the armed forces.
And this is the challenge, isn't it? Because Russia has not yet started to draft people from the largest urban centres, Moscow and St. Petersburg, at least not in any kind of scale. And it's tried to avoid that explicitly to prevent the kind of flight of its population that we saw after the first fairly mismanaged and miscommunicated mobilisation. Ukraine, however, has another challenge, and that is quite a number of people left the country at the start of the war. Others have left since, and there are people who are terrified of being mobilized, and not everyone is going to jump that opportunity, I would say. There are many who are, famous actors, singers, programmers, all sorts of people from every walk of life have joined and continue to join. But as you say, to match Russia's numbers, Ukraine will have to enact some form of mobilization at scale.
Yes, absolutely. And understandably, there's a lot of people are probably asking the question, why am I gonna willingly join the armed forces when the soldiers that are already serving don't even have enough ammunition? That means they're not gonna have any ammunition for me either. So these are things that have to happen in concert. The material support provided to Ukraine has to increase, but the manpower also has to increase. So I would say step one is ensure that the existing formations are adequately resourced with ammunition, equipment, etc. And at that point, then we need to ensure that in concert, Ukraine is mobilizing sufficient personnel and we're providing additional material for new units to be constituted. But even if there is no equipment, there's things that Ukraine can and should be doing, such as mobilizing people into like construction units, because this is another huge problem that exists where in many sectors of the front, the Ukrainians have not been very diligent in conducting construction efforts to build new defensive lines. And it's been largely left up to local commanders. So in some sectors, they have good fortifications, but in others, they have not been diligent in producing field fortifications. And so even if you don't have enough bullets for everybody, get people in construction units, military construction units, who are just responsible for undertaking those engineering activities, digging trenches and deploying obstacles, etc. The kind of heavy fortifications that the Russians built with the so-called Surovikin line. Ukraine needs to be doing the same thing. And I think that it was a huge mistake by military command not putting a greater emphasis on that. They seemed to think that they were just going to go on the counteroffensive against the Russians, and the Russians weren't going to take the strategic initiative back. So there's a lot of mistakes that have been made on their part as well. It's important, even though I spend a lot of time criticizing poor decisions that our politicians and Western countries have made, there have certainly been a lot of shortcomings on the Ukrainian side as well.
And indeed, don't want to give too much credit to the US administration, but they were strongly recommending from, I think it was sort of really autumn last year that Ukraine invests heavily in those defensive lines. So it's interesting that that wasn't fully followed up on. There's two areas I want to focus on. As we sort of finish up, one of course is Taurus and how important the supply of German Taurus missiles, again, not just a handful of units, but at scale is. How worrying is it that the production line for Taurus missiles has now shut down because there is no orders forthcoming from the German government? That's kind of one topic. And then once we covered that, I want to move on to the so-called gray zone warfare, which Russia is now seems to be. As predicted, as many like General Ben Hodges have predicted, it's escalating and probing and continues to do so in an incredibly aggressive fashion. Well, we'll cover that in a minute, but let's get to Taurus first.
Sure. So Taurus production has been shut for a while. I forget when the last order was and when the line shut down, but it was a while ago, so it's not a new problem. But MBDA Germany, who makes the missile, have stated that they have the ability to restart production, and it wouldn't take too long, but they need to have orders, and the German government has not even placed orders to refurbish their existing stock of missiles, many of which are not in usable condition because they're old and past their service life. So not even that step has been taken. So that's very unfortunate. The German government, if nothing else, for their own defenses, and they seem to be saying that, oh, Taurus is a very important capability for our own national security. And yet, strangely, they haven't spent the money to ensure that their entire missile inventory is available for them. They didn't take that step, and they haven't placed any new orders for Taurus, either for themselves or for anybody. Nobody else has looked to buy Taurus. So that's problematic. Taurus is very important because it offers enhanced capabilities over Storm Shadow and Scalpel G. And my colleague Fabian Hoffman has written extensively on this topic, everything to do with Taurus, including its technical characteristics. The basic thing to understand is that the fusing that the missile has is very sophisticated. So on Taurus, it has a fuse that is able to detect layers and voids. So if you imagine an underground bunker and you know where the bunker is, but it's fairly deep, and you want to be able to destroy the entire bunker all the way down to the bottom, say it's three or four stories, the Taurus missile can penetrate the roof of that bunker and then travel through the successive floors in that underground bunker and detect when it's passing through the void between the ceiling and the floor, penetrating through the next floor, and it can count all of that and detonate at the precise exact point where you want it to achieve maximum destruction. And that's a very sophisticated fuse system that Storm Shadow and Scalpel G don't have. This is a sophisticated cruise missile fusing. It also exists on the American JASSM missile, but Storm Shadow doesn't have it. So that's why Taurus offers an enhanced capability, and this would be particularly useful for destroying bridges. So to destroy the Kerch Bridge, right now Ukraine has Storm Shadow. Storm Shadow could do it, but it would take a lot more missiles. Taurus, you could do it with fewer missiles because of that very sophisticated fusing. You can penetrate the deck of the bridge, go through the road, and then hit the piers supporting the bridge underneath and detonate at the exact right point that you needed to collapse the bridge. And this, I think, is one of the reasons why Chancellor Scholz doesn't want to give it, because he doesn't want Ukraine to be able to destroy the Kerch Bridge. In his view, it would probably be far too escalatory, risk nuclear retaliation by Russia. So that's I think that's a key factor here in the Taurus debate, why it's so important, and also why Chancellor Scholz is unwilling to give that capability to Ukraine, and also because it is long range as well, 500, 600 kilometers. It's a weapon that Ukraine could use to strike Moscow, for example, and that as well as something that he would view as something that could risk nuclear escalation.
Well, I think we have to tackle that, don't we? Because I have heard that said quite a number of times. But Ukraine has shown that it is extremely diligent. If it is asked not to use systems outside of its sovereign territories, it has not done so, has it? It has stuck scrupulously to that request. So that seems to me that argument is something of an excuse, a straw man, which is not demonstrably shown by the reality that we've seen. However, nuclear escalation is something a little more abstract, isn't it? And in this sense, tapping into your studies of Russian narratives, they're extremely keen, aren't they, to make politicians like Biden, Sullivan, Schultz believe that somehow they're unhinged, believe they are a little bit mad, and that, we lose the Kerch Bridge, boom, it's nuclear war. Well, every red line which they've used so far and made the same kind of threats, there have been no consequences. Okay, they've hit Ukrainian civilians, they've taken out energy infrastructure, but they've been shown to be serial bluffers and bullies, haven't they? How does this work, though? Why is the coercive narratives so successful against sort of certain politicians?
Yeah, I wish I knew. The Russians certainly have been extremely effective with their nuclear saber rattling. Even though, as you say, we've seen that all of their so-called red lines that have already been crossed haven't resulted in really any escalation on their part. What else are they going to do? They're already trying to bomb Ukraine back into the Stone Age. Nuclear weapons is the only thing that they could really conceivably go to. And even though they threaten it routinely, we haven't seen them do it. But many Western politicians remain paralyzed in fear that they will resort to this. And it's quite bewildering that, particularly for the United States, that it seems that President Biden and many people in his administration view Russia's nuclear deterrent as far more threatening and far more capable than their own nuclear deterrent. The United States is unquestionably the more powerful country in this equation, but the United States doesn't seem to think that its own nuclear arsenal is a deterrent against Russia. Why Russia might not actually want to escalate. And the Russian playbook is very well understood by many astute observers of it, people who study this far more closely than I do. But they have this strategy of escalating their rhetoric, and they use that to cow us into acquiescing. And we've seen Putin do this since he came into power. Yet there's so many politicians here that haven't clued into his game plan and how it's fairly easy for us to push back against him. And through the credibility of our own nuclear deterrence, it's unlikely that he's going to escalate because he can't win that escalation. He can't win the escalation of conventional arms, and he can't win an escalation of nuclear arms either. The United States and NATO collectively absolutely has the upper hand in that equation.
And the last topic then is the grey zone warfare, because we've seen in the last couple of weeks extraordinary things happening. We've seen just in the last couple of days, we've seen murder of Ukrainian servicemen, and that may not be a state action, that may just be a deranged Zed patriot. But we have seen acts of sabotage or attempted sabotage against Ukrainian businesses in the UK. We've seen potential acts of sabotage against munitions factories. We see spy networks being uncovered. And of course, you also have spy equipment supposedly on some of that sort of grey fleet of tankers operating in the Baltic. And then there's the Baltic jammer out of Kaliningrad that is creating a very risky environment for civilian air traffic there, with up to 46,000 commercial planes having had their GPS systems jammed. Russia, it seems to me, thinks it's at war with us, and we are not reciprocating. What is going on here, and how further do you think Russia will escalate if it cannot make gains on the conventional battlefield?
Yeah, I think you said it yourself. They're already at war with us, but we seem to be in denial that they are. They've been waging asymmetric warfare against us for years. I mean, they did throughout the Cold War and even after, with Putin back in power. Their asymmetric or gray zone warfare has really just increased. There's a lengthy history of Russian military intelligence conducting bombings in NATO countries to disrupt our defense industry. And my colleagues at The Insider, Michael Weiss, Christo Grozev, do tremendous work exposing those activities. And in fact, just this morning published a new piece outlining two Russian assets in Czechia that have been involved with Russian military intelligence activities in these bombing campaigns that they've undertaken, and the assassinations, and of course the Havana Syndrome in Cuba as well, which again the Insider broke with 60 Minutes the latest developments on that story. So there's a whole pattern of behavior here on their part, but there seems to be still just a tremendous amount of denial in certain Western capitals that this is happening to us, and an unwillingness to really push back more aggressively against the Russians. And again, we know their playbook. They're going to continue to push against us, and if they don't get any pushback, they will escalate these malign asymmetric activities. They know that they're not going to directly start a shooting war with NATO forces right now. They're obviously embroiled in Ukraine and struggling there, but their asymmetric activities continue, and they continue globally as well. It's not just Europe. We can see that the Russian mercenary groups, Wagner, now folded under the Russian MOD, are still extremely active in Africa. So they're always looking for new fronts to expand the conflict to and gain further global influence. And I just don't understand why there isn't a greater sense of urgency to push back against these activities.
I think that's very, very clearly put, and that is a good sort of call to action, hopefully, at the end of our conversation. Colby, I'm so grateful to you for sharing these insights for the channel, and of course to you and your colleagues for doing such extraordinary in-depth analysis of what is happening, and very clear statement on what needs to change if Ukraine is to win. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.